Welcome back. To celebrate the 145th anniversary of W.E.B. Du Bois' birth, you heard a few weeks ago a series of conversations I had with Dr. David Levering Lewis, one of America's greatest scholars who won two Pulitzer Prizes for his biographies of W.E.B. Du Bois. The first was W.E.B. Du Bois' Biography of a Race, 1868 to 1919, and the second was W.E.B. Du Bois' 1919 to 1963, The Fight for Equality and the American Century. And now we share that interview with all of you. And Dr. David Levering Lewis, welcome.
Yeah, it's good to be here.
So let me start. This is I think that, you know, when you think of W.E.B. Du Bois, at least popularly, we think of his quotes about the 20th century being the century of race. We think about his comments about the talent and 10th. But Dr. David Levering Lewis, that just doesn't really, I mean, that's the kind of popular sense we get when you hear the man's name. But as you obviously have done in these two volumes, there's much greater depth to him and complexity to him.
Yes, certainly. So it's true that those taglines are what people immediately think of Du Bois when they hear. I suppose, though, you ask yourself the question: what would Du Bois think of the validity of that statement about the problem of the 20th century in the 21st century? And of course, I'm a historian, and a biographer, and I'm not expected or obligated to speak for Du Bois deceased in matters of beyond his time on Earth. But I think it's nonetheless both inescapable and appropriate to ask how that famous statement holds up in what has been described by some as a post-racial era, one certainly startlingly different from what Du Bois would have anticipated when we think of the presidency. And I've thought a fair amount about the utility, the validity of the indictment of the 20th century as racist in terms of today's situation. And I think that when you go back and read what Du Bois said around that statement, you would find it applicable, because what he was really talking about was the circumstances that are economic and political that result in the adverse impact upon the life opportunities of people of color or people of other descriptions who have great difficulty staying on the escalator of success in American society. And certainly race remains an element in that quest for success and prosperity and livelihood. But equally important, and perhaps more important, is the way in which the color-coded inheritance of race functions in the 21st century, when in fact the institutional disabilities around race have been dismantled formally, although they live on and with some vitality, but where it is the maldistribution of the goods of the society and the maldistribution of the wealth of the society that really are significant and are to be appreciated in terms of the meaning that Du Bois would, I think, give today to his prophetic judgment.
There's several things you said that I want to kind of parse and pull out here and kind of go in some depth, because I think that you speak to the complexity of this man, Du Bois, because he was. I mean, one of the things I loved about the way you approach him is that what you've done in these two volumes, and getting them was a pleasure. I've never really read them through until kind of preparing for your joining us today. Mm-hmm.
I'm afraid that's true of a large number of people.
Which is too bad, because it's amazing. But you really wrestle with his complexity. And this is a man who was W.E.B. Du Bois, born in a very white area of the Berkshire Mountains. His growing up, going to Fisk, of Haitian American, partially of descent. There's a complexity to his kind of detachment from the black race, and then his deep involvement in the black race. I mean, this is not somebody who you can just easily kind of put into kind of some kind of political, social, cultural pigeonhole.
That's true. And if one had simply to sum up this complexity that you allude to, Du Bois himself put it so well that as a biographer, I was really wonderfully advantaged. Mm. And I'm just walking across the room to find the statement I have in mind.
All right.
I think it's just right here. And it is that... ask your listeners' indulgence just a minute.
That's okay.
He was describing himself and his what he made of himself, and he said in his last memoir, the autobiography, a soliloquy on viewing my life from the last decade of its first century. He wrote this of himself. He said, had it not been for the race problem early thrust upon me and enveloping me, I should have probably been an unquestioning worshiper at the shrine of the established social order into which I was born. But just that part of this order, which seemed to most of my fellows nearest perfection, seemed to me to be most inequitable and wrong. And starting from that critique, I gradually, as the years went by, found other things to question in my environment. And I think that is just a brilliant summation of a life, an auto-summation, that, as you mentioned, he was born in a region of the country that was free of slavery, the formal institution of slavery, or had been for almost a century and a half. He grows up in a small town, a typical American town, where racism is not cruelly evident. He performs well in high school, and then thinking that he, having done well in school, would be able to go on to Harvard. He always had great ambitions, or Williams, just up the road, finds that his family resources are much too inadequate to make that possible, but that the philanthropy available for furthering his education is color-coded. So there's a scholarship to Fisk, a place he'd never heard of. And there at Fisk, he becomes a spokesperson early on for a problem, becomes the editor of the student newspaper, and then teaches in the outback of Tennessee, an area where the impact of slavery is still visible and salient. And then that quest for the Harvard education is realized, and then he becomes a stellar undergraduate at Harvard, and then on to the University of Berlin on a fellowship, which he forced the foundation to provide. It had advertised, the Slater Fund, that there were funds available to African Americans of ability, but when he applied, the foundation changed its objectives, and he was refused, and he felt humiliated. He felt that this was false advertising, and he wrote the president of the Slater Fund, who was the ex-president of the United States, Rutherford B. Hayes, the president who had presided over the demolition of Reconstruction.
Right.
He wrote him, and he said, "Sir, what is a man of color to do who meets all the requirements, who ambitions, who performs well, and then who has the rug pulled out from under him at a whim?" And that embarrassment, which he publicized, resulted in the granting of the fellowship and the 2 years at the University of Berlin, an exceptional place to be because, as your listeners may not know, in the late 19th century, the highest accolade for a man or whose professional ambitions were academic, the highest accolade was a German education, and that at the University of Berlin was at the top of the scale. He didn't earn the PhD in economics that he hoped for. He needed one more term, but the Slater Fund decided, having let him go that far, that he'd gone quite far enough. There was a debate that raged at about this time, which was I discovered as I got into the research for the life, that the Slater Fund, of course, was part of the establishment of the North, and there was a roiling debate about what to do with African American mobility, and it was decided that it would be a mistake for African Americans to be able to compete in all fields, and that indeed the role for educated people of color was service to their people humbly in the South, where the great numbers were, and indeed less so in the liberal arts, but in vocational education. And so Du Bois was simply a victim of a policy shift, which, of course, was he received as a very cruel deprivation. And so, as he said, and liked to say, with a twinkle in his eye, he had to return to the United States just short of the valued German doctorate, and he had to take second best, a Harvard PhD.
But a couple of things I want to make sure that we covered. One was, there's so much in his life that what it made me think of its relevance for today. And when you write in the second volume about Gunnar Myrdal, who wrote The American Dilemma, who was supposed to be the quintessential work on the work on race in America, some people would argue, and Du Bois, was really shunted aside in many ways around this when he wrote this book, I love the implication. Let me just read something that you wrote and just talk about this a moment. You wrote in the book how Du Bois meditated privately on the full implication of the subtitle of Volume 1 by Gunnar Myrdal, An American Dilemma, The Negro in a White Nation. And one of the things you write here is that the Negro was deprived of agency and rendered a problem for the white man to solve. Now, this is This goes on today. This never ends. It never ended in his life when he was kind of fighting for grants, whether it's from Carnegie and the other people who had wealth and what their agenda was for the America and black people in America, and how, and this still is an issue over the issue of agency and who controls whose life and who controls the struggle for real emancipation and freedom. But it was really came to fore in this Myrdal thing, and I think that the Gunnar Myrdal, and I think that's a huge piece of modern American sociology and history, has affected how people think in America today. And I was really kept thinking about that as I read that part of your book.
Yes, I found that really engrossing because I discovered the smoking gun. I hadn't expected to. That is to say, I had the impression that because Du Bois had, as early as 1905, asked Andrew Carnegie if he would underwrite a massive study of the race problem. And of course, Mr. Carnegie consulted Dr. Booker Washington and sent a polite declination. But Du Bois kept returning to his Negro Encyclopedia or Africa Encyclopedia idea, and without success. But persistent as a football player in the mid-30s, he finally got the foundations to recognize the importance of his idea. And they considered, indeed, funding an Encyclopedia of the Negro. They didn't think that they were going to have to do it, but it turned out that Du Bois sent out his précis of the scheme to all the academics on the planet. And so in from Germany, in from England, in from even South Africa, in from France came endorsements of not only the idea, but of Du Bois being the executor of it. And this embarrassed the foundations. They didn't know what the hell to do. And Du Bois actually was informally told that the grant had been approved by the General Education Board, that is to say, the Rockefellers. And he and Rayford Logan waited for the telephone call from New York affirming that. It didn't come. And they were puzzled. And they kept, well, you know, we're still working on this. And then one day, Gunnar Myrdal walks into Du Bois's office in Atlanta University with a member of the General Education Board, and they say, and the Carnegie Fund as well, and they say, oh, Dr. Du Bois, here is the man who's going to do your work, and we hope you can help him out. And once again, as with that poem that Mr. Grimmett read, he observed the form and was polite, but blown away. Well, I found in the Fisk University collection of Du Bois's papers an exchange between Robert Maynard Hutchins, the then genius boy president of the University of Chicago, and the director of the General Education Board. And Hutchins says, what's going on? We understand that there's a sociological research team on the top of the Chrysler Building looking at the Negro. What's that about? And the fellow says from the General Education Board, yes, this is the plan to study the Negro that Du Bois had in mind. Mm. And that we are going to do by having a Swede lead the pack. And then you look at the correspondence between Myrdal, and you see that he was the last they could find who could be, they said, objective enough to study this thorny problem. But Du Bois didn't know this, and he kept banging at the door, and the foundations became really quite sweaty about it. And so they finally got Myrdal, and they brought him over. They had a drink at the Century Club. They go south. They present Myrdal to Du Bois, and we're off and running with the grant of $250,000, which is lots of money then.
Lots of money.
And which goes up to $300,000 before it's over. And Myrdal then has the team that Du Bois had identified, including, of course, Ralph Bunche and the sociologists of E. Franklin Frazier and then the entire white community. Now, what's important here isn't that Du Bois didn't get to do what he wished so much to do. It was what it resulted in that Myrdal was one of Europe's leading economists. And yet, the American Dilemma has no economics in it. In the appendix, you'll find the economics, but it is scrupulously silent about economics. It has to do with the consequences of economic injustice, but it doesn't go to the root problem. You can't imagine had Du Bois had a leading role in this, and he elected not to because he could see what was going to happen. If he had, you would have had economics stippled throughout the text.
Here you have W.E.B. Du Bois, who from the beginning was a Pan-Africanist. Many people call him the father of the Pan-African movement globally, whether it was the founding NAACP, the conferences that he went to in Europe, the people he met, to his ending his life in Ghana, being welcomed by Kwame Nkrumah, who was the embodiment of modern Pan-Africanism in many ways. But it was also that period from the 30s on when he began studying Marx, when Ralph Bunche was studying Marx, and people don't think about that in terms of Ralph Bunche, but how he ended up taking Marx in terms of his economic analysis and adding to it the complexity of race in America, but led him to be a Marxist, which is where he and ending his days that way as well, kind of marrying his Marxism and Pan-Africanism, and dying in Ghana after being attacked by American government for being a communist earlier. So could you talk to that a bit about that? Can we just conclude a bit about talking about that whole kind of arc of his life?
Well, I think you describe it quite well. He does find that Marx, analytically, clears up the morass around race relations quite handsomely. But as you say, he's aware that the Marx as a tool of analysis is great insofar as it goes. However, it doesn't address race. Now, Marxists would vehemently deny that, but it's simply true that it is that economic prosperity does not necessarily lead to racial racial opportunity. It does not have to do that. South Africa is a while apartheid existed, is an example of the two track economics of a society where race is embedded and you get a Herrenvolk democracy. And that's what he saw happening with the American labor movement, that until the late 1930s, when the CIO edged aside the AFL in its organizing activities throughout the South, there Du Bois was heartened because he could see that that a social democracy in which race was recognized as an element was a possibility. The problem was, as he saw it, that opportunity, which came in the mid-40s, ended in 1948 by the pivotal election of that year. The defeat of Henry Wallace's Progressive Party ended the kind of social democracy momentum that Du Bois thought he saw on the left. To a great degree, it was, because from that time on, a new term describes what is going on when it comes to race relations in America, Cold War civil rights. Mm. And that is, as A. Philip Randolph famously said, it's hard enough to be black, it's just death to be red. And so the black civil rights movements, whether they should have been more courageous or not, you can debate, but they trimmed their sails. They cut off their interest in Pan-Africanism. They were cautious about critiquing American foreign policy. The expression was, the criticism of America stops at the water's edge. Mm-hmm. Within that dichotomy, Du Bois couldn't fit. He couldn't trim his sails. There was no left he could see that was going to survive, he thought. So he made the decision to be part of the global movement that early on he had anticipated as being crucial to civil rights advancement, and that was the empowerment of people of color globally. And so off to Ghana.
Mm. Well, this was there's so much to say. We could spend another 2 hours doing this, but I know that everybody has a life to live. I want to thank you deeply, Dr. David Levering Lewis, for spending this amount of time with us in this conversation about W.E.B. Du Bois.
Yes.
It's always a pleasure to talk about W.E.B. Du Bois, and thank you very much, sir.
We have to take a very brief break. We're coming right back. We jump right into a brand new episode of Soundbites.